Next case is the President and Fellows of Harvard College and DuPont v. the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Mr. Donner, appellants often bring samples of the item at issue. You did not bring a sample of the Harvard mouse.
Your Honor, I left the mouse home.
There's probably several of them at your house.
I promise not to roar, though.
Please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. At the heart of the PTO Director's holding is that the evidence of whether a term disclaimer fee was paid was inconclusive. I submit that it's anything but inconclusive. In fact, I submit the evidence is overwhelming that no fee was paid.
But this was about a disclaimer, and the disclaimer said the fee is paid herewith, or similarly.
Your Honor, the disclaimer did say the fee was paid, and there was also a general authorization on which the PTO relies. Neither one is conclusive in this case. In fact, that really raises the question. The fact is that the standard practice of the Patent and Trademark Office on five different items that were supposed to have been taken care of were not taken care of.
I feel like the standard you're articulating isn't right. You're saying the fact that it said on its face that the fee was paid isn't conclusive. But right now, that doesn't seem to me to be the vantage point that we are allowed to look at this case from. It seems that this is a fact question that gets the highest level of deference, according to the Supreme Court, that you ever give to any sort of factual determination, which is rational basis review. I don't think whether the PTO showed that there was conclusive evidence the fee was paid is at all, unfortunately for you, that's not at all the right standard.
We're supposed
to see is there any rational basis for their conclusion.
Your Honor, my argument is not that the Patent Office has to show there was a conclusive basis. My argument is that Harvard has shown conclusively as close to zero probability that the fee was paid as you can possibly get. I accept the burden. I'm not suggesting it's the PTO's burden. I'm suggesting that the Patent Office has standard procedures. There were five things that should have been done if this fee was paid. None of those five things was done. Moreover, every item in the file, five different items where a fee was paid, were done correctly. Namely, there was a date stamp, there was an indication that the fee was paid on five different items. Coupled with that, you had the law firm representing Harvard had a standard practice of putting a copy of the check that was paid in the file. That check was not there.
The rejection was withdrawn, which had to have meant that the disclaimer was effective.
That is not so, Your Honor, and the reason it was not so is, first of all, the director said that that event was inconclusive. That's the director's words. Secondly, the paper in which that paper was filed had two different items. It had an extra claim, an extra independent claim. The fee could have referred to that. Moreover, the same examiner that withdrew the rejection in the application in which the claims were ultimately filed, the 803 patent application, found that there was no patently distinct inventions.
But that's not relevant to whether or not the 774 accepted the terminal disclaimer, because that occurred later. I mean, it just seems to me when I went through the file wrapper that there were some claims for which no argument was made but the terminal disclaimer argument. So it's hard for me to imagine on what basis the PTO would have withdrawn the double patenting rejection if not the terminal disclaimer, because no other argument was even vaguely made on some of the claims.
Your Honor, my answer was a response to Judge Lurie's question. I'm not arguing that that proves our case. I'm merely saying his question was the fact that the examiner withdrew the thing, doesn't that militate against Harvard's position? I'm merely suggesting it doesn't militate. It may be that the examiner never saw the term of the disclaimer. There are lots of reasons for her to have withdrawn the rejection.
What? Because for some of the claims, no other argument against the rejection was made except reference to the terminal disclaimer. So So what other basis could there be, at least in this record, that has any support for that examiner withdrawing that rejection?
Your Honor, let's assume that that was the basis. The issue is, in the Vectra Fitness case, on which the PTO relies very heavily, the court made absolutely clear that the payment of a fee for a terminal disclaimer was the sine qua non for that terminal disclaimer to be effective. So the issue is, was a fee paid? Whether the examiner withdrew the rejection for reason A or reason B doesn't dictate the answer. The question is, was a fee paid? I suggest...
But can't we assume, or at least doesn't it factually support the PTO, the fact that the examiner withdrew the rejection and allowed those claims for no reason in the file history but for the terminal disclaimer? The examiner understood the requirement that a terminal disclaimer has to be paid to be effective. Doesn't that create a minimum circumstantial evidence that would support the PTO's ultimate conclusion?
Your Honor, it is a piece of evidence, but when you weigh that piece of evidence against all the other evidence, I suggest from a statistical standpoint, the probability that this fee was paid is less than 1%. Less than 1%. And the fact that you have all of these pieces of evidence put together suggesting overwhelmingly that no fee was paid, I suggest it makes no difference what the reason was for the withdrawal of the double patenting rejection. It may be because of the fact that the terminal disclaimer had no markings on it, it didn't have any fee stamp, it didn't have a paper number, it may have been put in the file electronically or otherwise. The examiner may not have seen that terminal disclaimer. My point is that the key issue in this case was a fee paid. That is the issue.
The evidence that you have with respect to the sort of absence of payment is that there's no copy of a check in the file, right?
And no cancel check.
And no cancel check. So now we don't have, unfortunately, records from the PTO because they don't go back that far. But in terms of, so essentially you're trying to prove a negative, is that right here?
I'm trying to prove that no fee was paid.
All right, and I understand your position that it doesn't really matter if the examiner relied on the terminal disclaimer. We know she never said she was relying on a terminal disclaimer, but and because we have said you have to have that fee before it can ever be effective.
Yes.
Right. Now, the PTO says, it says on its face that the check is enclosed, and we have no records that show it wasn't enclosed, and it at least is arguable that it was meaningful to the examiner. Why isn't that, maybe just barely, but why isn't that enough, despite your evidence that there's no other indication that it was paid?
Your Honor, you say there's no evidence that it wasn't enclosed. I disagree with that. There's overwhelming evidence that it wasn't enclosed, because the PTO rules, the MPEP, the standard practice, was to do all the things that were not done in this case. All the things that were not done. Five different events. And there were five different events when they should have been done, when fees were paid, that it was done. Coupled with the Fish and Richardson, the law firm representing Harvard, records themselves. I suggest that is powerful evidence.
So you're not arguing that those five events are necessary to make a terminal disclaimer valid?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Because you couldn't really make that argument.
That argument was made in Vectra Fitness,
right,
which is why Vectra Fitness is distinguishable.
All right, so all you're arguing is that the fact that those five things weren't done is indicative of the fact that the terminal disclaimer was not processed in the normal course?
Yes, I would disagree with only one word, indicative. I think it proves almost to a certainty, beyond a criminal standard, beyond a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, it is close to 0%, below 1%, that the fee was paid. And the fact that it states that a fee was paid has to be weighed against this overwhelming evidence to the contrary. And the general authorization, we've pointed out in our brief, does not apply to terminal disclaimers, and so that doesn't help them at all. And in fact, we include a sample from another case in the record in which a general authorization was made and the fee stamp was put on the document showing that the fee was paid. So the uniform policy of the PTO is to do X, Y, and Z, and none of that was done. I'd say...
Not the uniform policy, the particular practice, right? Not the uniform policy. There is no policy statement that governed those five things you referred to. You're saying the consistent practice of the PTO was to regularly do those things, right? There isn't some policy statement in the MPEP that required the PTO to follow that practice in every case.
Your Honor, I'm not sure what you mean by policy, but I will answer you directly. There are statements in the rules and in the MPEP saying that X should be done and Y should be done. And in fact, X is done and Y is done in almost all the cases. And so you can call it policy or not, but I do suggest if you look at Bristol-Myers Squibb versus Rhone-Palanque, you find in that case where the PTO did not follow the rules, the presumption of regularity was not applied in that case. In fact, I suggest the presumption of regularity should apply in favor of Harvard. And the reason it should is the presumption of regularity by virtue of this practice, policy, whatever you want to call it, the rules expressly say the things that I'm saying and or the MPEP. The failure to follow this policy suggests that the presumption of regularity works in favor of Harvard, not in favor of the PTO. So we have one, they rely heavily on a presumption of regularity in their favor. I suggest it's relevant, but it's relevant in favor of Harvard. Two, you have all these pieces of evidence, and we're not saying...
I know, your evidence is very strong, and if I reviewed this case de novo, Mr. Dunner, I'd likely go with you. But the problem for me is the standard of review in the face of the fact that you submitted a document as part of this file that said fee attached. And you want to point to things that are somewhat circumstantial, but they didn't stamp this other thing and they didn't file this other thing. But in the record itself is a document from your client that says fee attached.
Your Honor?
I just don't see how that doesn't end this under the standard of review.
Your Honor, the standard of review, both sides have cited different cases on what arbitrary and capricious is, what the standard is.
Well, the Supreme Court
clear
said,
error of judgment.
The Supreme Court has said it's the most highly deferential.
It is highly deferential. I know it's not permissible for lawyers to ask judges hypotheticals, but may I?
No.
Well, I would like to make a statement. I'll pose it as a statement then.
Rhetorical. Go ahead.
The statement is that in a case in which I could prove that, in fact, the Patent Office record, some record said no fee was paid, notwithstanding the fact that the terminal disclaimer said attached is a fee, that certainly would be enough if I had a Patent Office record that said that. I submit that that would be the case. I further submit that that's where I am because the evidence is overwhelming, almost to a zero statistical probability that no fee was paid, that's fully equivalent to a PTO. I get this from the PTO's own records. And even though I don't have a record saying no fee was paid, I have evidence, which is perhaps circumstantial, but overwhelmingly circumstantial in our favor. I submit that does satisfy even the highest burden. I think we can satisfy a burden higher than a criminal burden.
Mr. Tanner, having heard your rhetorical statement, I think you probably want to save some rebuttal time.
I do. Thank you.
We'll hear from Mr. Bowden.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Over 26 years ago, in order to overcome a double patenting rejection, Harvard, of their own accord, filed a terminal disclaimer with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Since that time, that extremely broad terminal disclaimer, written by its own attorneys, has resided in the file wrapper for the public at large to review and to plan their conduct against.
But doesn't a notice of a disclaimer appear on the face of a patent?
It does normally. That's correct.
Didn't here, right?
It did not here, and it did not in Detra Fitness. And it was not of concern to the validity of that terminal disclaimer in Vector Fitness, just like it is not a concern to the validity of the terminal disclaimer here.
You keep hammering on the fact, or you were hammering there and you did in your brief, on the fact that they did this voluntarily. They don't dispute that they did it voluntarily.
No.
All they dispute is that, you know, PTO relies on technicalities all the time. We have said that that has to be paid. The PTO has said the fee has to be paid, we've said the fee has to be paid, or it's not valid. You agree with that proposition?
I actually do not, Judge O'Malley, with respect. This court has never held that if a party whose responsibility it is to pay the fee does not, and B, the government fails in its ministerial duty to collect the fee. That is, an error occurs both on the applicant and on the office's watch. But a terminal disclaimer nevertheless is, quote unquote, recorded in the file wrapper and remains in the file wrapper, that it is invalid. This court did not so hold in Vector Fitness. In fact, there are any number of cases from the Supreme Court on down, beginning in the late part of the 19th century, that stands for the proposition that when the government fails in a ministerial duty, even if the statute or regulation governing that duty is, quote unquote, mandatory, it does not mean that the ensuing action automatically loses force. I would submit to your honors that that is exactly what ought to happen in this context as a matter of law, especially given what we see in this court's Vector Fitness decision about the reliance that the public at large has to the presence of a terminal disclaimer in the file.
I don't understand that to be your argument in your briefs at all. Am I mistaken? I thought your argument in the briefs was one that defended the fact-finding that the fee wasn't paid. I didn't understand your argument to be, well, if the government failed to do the duty of collecting the fee as it otherwise should have as a ministerial matter, that ought to be excused and the terminal disclaimer is nonetheless valid. Am I mistaken about how I remember your brief?
You are not mistaken, with the exception that we argued both. I would agree with Your Honor that we were far stronger in our brief, in both words and tone, I presume, on the question about the factual finding, as Your Honor's colloquy with my friend indicates about the degree of deference that both this court and the district court owed to the USPTO's factual finding under the APA.
Well, but where did you make the alternative arguments in your brief? Can you point
if I make it in my brief, I apologize. I don't have it on my head. At pages 27 and 28, we make the point that I just articulated to you, Judge O'Malley, that this court had never held that that the failure to pay a fee, if caught later on down the line, allows the applicant who submitted the terminal disclaimer to avoid the consequences of that terminal disclaimer. It begins at the end of page 27 and at page 28. And as I just indicated to Judge Moore, I would concur with her that our argument here is far less vociferous than it is than our fact-finding argument, but it is present nonetheless.
You're bewildering me. After the entire colloquy we had with Mr. Dunner, I'm surprised that this is where you've begun your argument. You've chosen to begin your argument with an argument that occupies at most one to two sentences in your entire brief, which doesn't seem to me to be anywhere near your stronger argument. So why are you starting here?
I was simply answering...
Is it because you think everything else is so weak?
Not in the slightest, Your Honor. I was simply answering...
Why don't you start with what you think is your strongest argument?
I believe our strongest argument is exactly what you articulated, Judge, that the Supreme Court has, from time immemorial, articulated that the factual findings of an agency, when it does so pursuant to its obligations, is subject to the highest deference from an Article III court. Judge Lurie, Your Honor, held that in In re Gartside, and as Judge Moore, you articulated with my colleague, the Supreme Court has held identically. That so long as there is any rational basis for the factual finding in the record, then this court must affirm, and the district court must affirm in its appellate role under the APA identically.
How about the presumption of regularity? I'm not convinced that you get the presumption of regularity here because everything virtually was irregular about this. And so in the absence of taking all the steps or at least taking the majority of the steps, I can't see how you could get a presumption of regularity from this. But how do you respond to Mr. Dunner's point that, in fact, it was so irregular that the presumption should weigh in their favor?
Well, I think there are two responses to that, Your Honor. Number one, the same presumption of regularity issues were present, the underlying factual underpinnings of that were present in Vector Fitness. And despite all of those indicia of irregularity, this court still said the terminal disclaimer was valid. Nonetheless, the Patent Office's factual finding has at least some rational basis in the record. Even if we do not get the presumption of regularity, which the terminal disclaimer placed in the file, I agree with you that there were a ton of irregularities about how it was placed in the file. It still was placed in the file. The PTO's instructions to its examiners and its staff are not put the terminal disclaimer in the file unless it's paid for. There are at least some indicia
of... And those
of,
instructions come from where?
They come from partly the MPEP and partly from, as Judge Moore said earlier, from common practice. But in any event, there are certain indicia of that the fee was paid. Number one, as Judge O'Malley, I think you articulated to my colleague, that there was an explicit statement in the documents that the fee was attached. Now, they're not able to find a canceled check, but that's not definitive in any way, shape, or form, as the USPTO said. Second, the documents themselves that included the terminal disclaimer provided a general authorization to charge the fees to Harvard's account. And yes, it may be true that that practice for terminal disclaimer fees was not allowed. But what is ironic about this position from my colleagues is that they are asking, and they ask the district court, to definitively find that their counsel, at the time of the application, made a mistake. I said something in these documents, i.e., that there was a check attached to the filing, and that didn't happen. It was a mistake. But they are unwilling, on the other flip side of the coin, to entertain the prospect that although the Patent Office's practice may not have been to allow post-issuance terminal disclaimer fees to be charged to a general account, it may have just happened in any event.
But
and the reason
the
we don't...
pretty strict about that. I mean, there's no evidence that they've ever allowed a terminal disclaimer to be charged to an account, and there are repeated references to not making sure that doesn't happen.
But there's also no evidence that it didn't happen in the past over any number of applications. And that's what is also interesting about the position that we hear that Harvard's evidence was unrefuted. These are ex parte proceedings. The USPTO serves as an arbiter, not as an adversary, and so it is not the USPTO's job to refute that evidence during those proceedings.
So you're saying we shouldn't assume that Harvard's lawyer screwed up, we should assume the PTO screwed
you
up?
You could assume either way. All that matters, as Judge Moore has said, is that there is some rational basis for the decision in the record, and I would submit to you that there is at least that.
All right, so you're saying putting aside presumption of regularity, all you need is some rational basis for having said that it's more likely than not.
That is correct.
And your evidence is, one, that in fact the face of the document said the check's here.
Correct.
And two, that it got put in the file.
Three, that there was an authorization within those papers for the fees to be paid from the general account of Harvard at the time, and we have no records of that because Harvard waited 25 years to raise this issue.
I'm having a hard time with your latches argument as long as you're going there.
Sure.
I mean, if there's no authority to withdraw, and the PTO is very strict about that, can't withdraw a terminal disclaimer, how could they have latches if they couldn't have done anything about it?
Well, they certainly could have done something about it between the time that the terminal disclaimer was filed with the Patent Office and the patent issued, over 3 years of time. Nor was this an ordinary set of circumstances for Harvard. As they say in their papers here and in the district court, they A, believe that the examiner did not believe the terminal disclaimer necessary, and B, that that the very claims over which the terminal disclaimer was relevant were canceled. They had every reason in the world to ensure that, just as Judge Lori held in In Re Yamazaki, that before the issue fee is paid, before the patent issues, that file does not contain a terminal disclaimer.
But did they know over this period of years that the fee was not paid, had not been paid?
There is no evidence on that in the record at all.
How does Latches attach?
Well, I think Latches attaches because we have a document filed in 1988. We had nothing occurring from 1988 until 2010. Over that period of time, it's impossible to know the number of individuals that have reviewed that file wrapper and have determined that there is a terminal disclaimer here, and as a result, I'm going to guide my conduct accordingly.
But there's no evidence that they knew about it earlier, that the fee had not been paid, and that these 20-some years passed without their acting on actual knowledge.
I would argue, Your Honor, that it was incumbent on Harvard to put that evidence before the district court, and they did not. Their papers are devoid of any mention in the district court of Latches whatsoever, despite the fact that the Patent Office raised that in their motion papers. There was nothing in the record at all. And in fact, if you look at the colloquy with Judge O'Grady in the district court, counsel for Harvard at the time said that their defense to Latches was, well, as soon as we heard about this in the re-exam context, we joined the issue immediately. Now, in their reply brief in this court, we hear that they've done an investigation and that they learned about the issue in 2006. It was incumbent on them, Judge, to put that in the record at the time. And of course, Your Honor, in that respect, I think it is important to remember that this court's review of the Latches decision by the district court is subjected to abuse of discretion only. And I do not believe that Harvard can meet that standard here. Your Honor, to conclude, Harvard here fully intended to file a disclaimer and to pay the fee associated with its filing. Whether characterized as plaintiffs as Harvard's failure to pay the fee or USPTO's failure to collect it, there is at least a rational, factual basis in the record to conclude that the fee is paid, and Harvard, now 24 years on, should not be able to avoid the consequences of its own intentional action.
Counsel, I'd like to make one comment.
Absolutely.
I would advise you in the future to stop talking to an appellate court about what one and claiming one individual judge held something in this case, that case, or the other case. Judge Lurie or I may have authored a given case, but I didn't hold that. I can only hold on behalf of the court, and I can only do so with the majority, at least, of a panel. And so it's quite frankly a little bit pandering and a little bit insulting for you to suggest that Judge Lurie himself or I myself effectuated some holding. So I would caution you in the future to hold back a little bit in your exuberance to attribute it to a single judge.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you. Thank the court for its time today.
Thank you, Mr. Boggan. Mr. Donner, we'll round up your rebuttal time to 2 minutes.
How many minutes?
2 minutes, if you need it.
I'll speak quickly. First of all, my colleague talks about the payment of the fee being a ministerial duty. That is clearly not so. Not only does Vectra Fitness say it's a mandatory duty, Section 253 of the statute says it's mandatory. PTO Rule 321B says it's mandatory.
But does Vectra Fitness say it's mandatory for purposes of the PTO's actions, or does it say it's mandatory before a patentee could rely on it, or an applicant could rely
on
it?
Your Honor, it says it's talking about what constitutes when you can record it, when it's considered recording a paper. And it says, in order for a terminal disclaimer to be recorded, the fee must be paid. And then in the later part of the opinion, it says that's analogous to whether or not a terminal disclaimer is valid. So I think it says both. In response to some questions asked by Judge Moore about the failure to follow its own regulations and whether or not it's a policy, I would direct the court to page 34 of the blue brief, Simmons versus Block. It's an 11th Circuit case. It's not binding, but it says failure to follow the one's own regulations is arbitrary and capricious. On the general authorization issue,
if they fail to follow a regulation is something found in the CFR. Or did they fail you to follow the MPEP, which we all agree is not binding on anyone?
It uses the word regulations.
But regulation's different, right? Regulation is the force and effect of law, and the MPEP does not.
Well, some of our points are based on rules, and I would consider that a regulation, certainly. On the question of whether or not the argument is made, there's some evidence, and that is a rational basis. My bottom line point is that there has to be some measure of what some means. If some means next to nothing, that is not some, and I suggest that is the situation here. On the Lashes point, the waiver point, we cite three things showing we've raised it below: 1379, 5319, 5238, and whether we could have done something during the prosecution of the 571 patent. There were 2 years and 3 months between the terminal disclaimer and the issuance of that patent, and there was nothing suggesting, nothing bringing it to our attention, nothing prompting them to review. And any, you know, I was a patent lawyer, and I cannot imagine going back and saying, was a fee paid as I'm prosecuting the case? There was nothing, there was no reason they should have known that until 2006, when we acknowledged in the footnote, because we had to.
Wait, so you're saying in 2006 was the first time you could have figured out, or they could have figured out, that a fee wasn't paid?
It depends what you mean by could have figured out. If somebody went back and said, hey, are there any records of anything happening? Or, hey, do our own files show anything? They could have done that, conceivably.
So are you saying that a standard patent attorney who was prosecuting that application at the time would have believed the fee had been paid?
He would have had no reason to believe that no fee had been paid. That's exactly right. He would have believed that a fee had been paid based on the statement that a fee had been paid. All I'm saying is he might have believed that, but it would not have been true.
Thank you, Mr. Donner. We'll take the case under advisement. And as a follow-up to what Judge Moore said about attributing holdings to individual judges, I share Judge Moore's comment, and I think most of the court would as well. This case will be taken under advisement.